You are listening to Ismail Hassan. I am the founder and head coach of Aikido of London. Welcome to the Aikido of London discussion series. Today's chat is with Alex Barrera, or should I say Alejandro Barrera, and he'll be chatting with me today from Madrid. And this, the discussion is about habit building and how traditional arts help you focus on the long term for gradual betterment. Hello, Alex, and thanks for joining us today. Could you introduce yourself and explain a little bit about your background before we begin this discussion?
Well, hello, Sensei. Hello, Ismail. Pleasure joining you for the podcast. So, as you said, my name is normally Alejandro, but people have a hard time pronouncing that, so it's easier to say Alex. I'm a Spaniard. I'm a computer engineer. I've been working extensively with startups and entrepreneurs, and I've also been a practitioner of Aikido for quite some years now. So that's kind of my background.
Thank you for that introduction. That's a great question you've got there. Habit building and how traditional arts help you focus on the long term for gradual betterment. Two parts, isn't it? There's that, firstly, the habit building aspect of this. It's an interesting discussion. We all have habits of sorts of in life, in our activities, and in our work. And what aspect of it did you want to really talk about?
Well, I think habits are one of those things that allows us to ground ourselves. And my experience is that when you talk with a lot of people in the Western world and you talk around habit building, their understanding about habits is going to the gym. And I think that when you talk to people like us, where we practice something that has no defined end goal, right, in the sense that you start, it's a way, and you start and you never know when you're going to finish until you die, basically. It's probably a very different way of approaching a habit. And so for me, it's interesting to talk around that difference and what does it bring psychologically, and what kind of benefits does it bring to your day-to-day life, both at home and also at your work.
I like what you're saying, and what I would do is I would actually dissect it and change the terminology a little bit. The habit of going to a gym or any other ritual that we all participate in, what I would say is I would use the term routine rather than habit. So that is a scheduled or organized pattern that sounds like a habit, and it can become a habit, but hopefully if it's fresh, it's a routine that you do for your personal reasons. Regarding habits, it's a fascinating one on a certain sort of pathway that if I get personal here, that in recent years as I've continued in this training, I always emphasize to people, and you've probably heard me, for the record, everybody, I first met Alex in Coruña in the Galician province of Spain about three, maybe 4 years ago now, Alex?
4 years, yeah, something that.
Four years. And it's been, aside of seminars, it's been a kind of a long distance relationship. But anyway, sidetracking there a little, going back, this thing about habit and getting people to wake up to body habits that they bring to class. So if we speak specifically about Aikido for the moment, you see how people handle their bodies, how they move in a way that is familiar to them or unconscious to them. And as an instructor, you have the task of unraveling some of that, trying to bring them back to a more quote unquote a natural state in their body. Presumably the one we're born with, just a little older and informed. But what came about was that learn good habits, and this is you'll hear this just about everywhere, and you'll hear this outside of the world of Aikido. It needn't apply to martial art or Aikido. It can apply to anything. Learn good habits. Learn good behavior patterns that are positive and potentially creative in whatever you do. But it obscures something which is, I think, more powerful and deeper. And that good habits are still habits. So bad habits, good habits, both are habits. And so you have to reach a stage where you have no habit, and that is and so one could argue, okay, what is can such a thing exist? And the answer is yes, because if we go beyond the terminology once more, you have to look at yourself in terms of presence of mind. And yes, one conditions one's body. One, if one is stiff and it lacks malleability, that is not a good way if you're going to do something like a martial art. If you're mentally rigid, it's not good for you in your profession or in any walk of life, I would argue. But learning how to utilize your body and your mind, your spirit in the best way possible, and the notion of being on your toes, alive, awake in whatever you do, is a different thing. That's not a habit. That means you're bringing you, Alex Barrera, me, Ismail Hassan, and anyone else, and whether it be your personal life, your professional life, or life in general, that you're present, and that present has no habit. It is just a state of mind where there's possibility of enjoying that particular moment, or being productive at that particular moment, or having some great training at that particular moment.
Yeah,
it's a little different from maybe what you were thinking.
Well, no, I think you made a very important distinction. And if you dig down and you break up the definition, right? A habit is a repetitive pattern. But as you just said, there are many ways of doing a repetitive pattern, right? And there are many parts on this. First one is, how do you build the capacity to do a repetitive pattern in the first place, which we can talk about in a second. But the one you were talking a moment ago is, there are certain patterns or certain pattern capacity building that allows you to create this feeling of introspection, this growth feeling, right? There's certain repetitions that no matter how many times you do them, they're just not going to make you better. It's not going to bring you insight. Or just let me rephrase this with an example. People that go to the gym, but they just go there to spend the time, or even to play a tennis match or a football match or whatever, there's nothing wrong with it. They actually obtain certain benefits from the habit of doing sports. But in most situations, there isn't that self-awareness, as you were putting that, as being there in the moment, which is one of those elements that turns that kind of entertainment habit or entertainment space into a habit building situation, or a situation where you actually grow and you gain insight as you repeat the pattern, right? It's the difference between continuous improvement and no improvement at all. Where, I mean, you obviously always, the more you repeat something, the more you improve. But for a lot of people, that's not the goal. The goal is, hey, I'm going to go there, I'm going to have fun.
If I can interrupt there, I would not agree through the repetition. Yes, there is repetition. That goes without saying. And sometimes something has to be drummed in until it becomes second nature, and it becomes a part of you. If we are going to tap into that growth and evolution that you're talking about. But there's another aspect that if you address that wrong, it can become monotonous, robotic, and mechanical, and in which case there is no insight and there is no development, because you're not really addressing the core issue. It could be anything. You could be playing tennis and you're always getting stuck in a particular thing, and you're not maybe really aware of it or conscious, or maybe even that bothered with it. You just tell yourself, I'm not that good at it, and it stops there. and maybe the more inquisitive mind or the more hungry to get better at tennis ask themselves a question. Maybe they film it, maybe they take a look at it, and then they see something's wrong. Maybe they get some professional coaching and they return to the same problem and they address it maybe with a little bit more wisdom and with a little bit more awareness, and they work at it again. And in this case, the repetition is mindful. It's back to the presence of mind.
Yeah.
Which is essential.
Yeah, I think that concept of awareness, of being mindful about it, it's what's probably critical, in the sense that you're very right. Like, doing repetition without being aware of certain things just gets you stuck. And I would even say that for some people, being aware of certain aspects of their practice, of their habits, the goal for them is one, and it doesn't necessarily need to be the same for everyone. That's one thing I see people saying, like, okay, the goal is this. It's like, well, that is your goal. You've probably seen this on the mat. I see a lot of people that come and train because for them is physical exercise, and that is their goal. And as such, obviously, their introspection or their mindfulness around their practice is completely different to maybe a competitive approach or even a personal growth approach, right? So everyone has their own reason to be mindful.
We're all different. We all have our own aptitudes, capacities, objectives, and they change. The longer you do something, especially something that you particularly enjoy, and something that you are maybe even doing well in, and so enjoying it doesn't necessarily mean you're getting better at it. It means that you enjoy repeating in a sense of going to the fairground, and you like the roller coaster, and the roller coaster never changes, but you love the thrill, so you go back on and you repeat it. Which is an interesting thing, because we're also talking about novelty, and so if someone starts in training, they may enjoy that initial thrill, that being a beginner, not knowing what it is, and getting the excitement out of that. But as time goes by, you may progress well within that framework. There's nothing wrong with that. Even a little bit of competition chucked in, bearing in mind that Aikido is not supposed to be competitive. But in a broader sense, there's nothing wrong with bringing that kind of energy constructively into a situation. But the novelty, no matter how good you are and no matter how enthusiastic you are and how much you like it, if it's just the excitement and the fun that you are addressing, the novelty runs out. It may take a couple of years. It may take maybe a 7-year itch, if you want to call it that. And many stop and they disappear, as you probably realize. But for many, it's like a decision has got to be made suddenly. It's like, oh, I've got to work now. I've got to think about this more. In many cases, the eyes are opening up for the first time. The insight is being tickled for the first time, and then it becomes suddenly it's not the art they started with. It's something completely different at such a time. And I'd like to ask you a question regarding that. Not Aikido, not martial arts, but in a broader sense, in your profession, which I know you're very committed to, and you've invested a lot of time and energy in. Do you see parallels and how this crosses over, and how does it express itself? How does it show itself in your
profession? That's a good question. Actually, I was just thinking while you were mentioning this novelty issue, the typical conversation that I think most of us have had with our partners or with friends, which is the difference between a hobby and a practice, right? That novelty for me is, hey, I have a hobby I enjoy. And eventually that initial spark goes away, and then you start building a practice, which is a very different thing. And I used to have this discussion with my wife, because she was like, yeah, you have all these hobbies that take all that time. And I was like, look, this is not a hobby. I don't do this to have fun, which I do have fun, don't get me wrong, but I don't do it because of that. And one of the things I used to tell her is the reason why I train, the reason why, and just to give a little bit of context, I do three things that kind of fall directly into the traditional arts path, right? One is Aikido. The other one is Shodo, so Japanese calligraphy. I also do Chado, which is the way of tea. And I would probably add a fourth one that kind of connects everything, which is meditation and Zen. And when I discuss this with my wife, one of the things I always tell her is like, the reason why I do these things is because I need them to do my job. And it's something that for a lot of people is kind of weird, because it's like, no, that's your hobby. You know, why are you talking about your job? And I'm like, well, because what you don't see is that for me, my job, meditation, Aikido, Shodo, and Chado are one and the same. I wouldn't be able to do my job if I don't have that space during the day or during the week to think differently, to you know, have a different part of me analyzing, or even just not doing anything. Like a good example for me is Chado. When you do tea, we're so used to going fast around our lives, right? Well, now with the lockdowns, it's not the case, but a lot of people are used to doing so many things at the same time. And when you do tea, there's one thing that you just cannot rush, is the tea takes the time it takes. Boiling water takes the time it takes. And you cannot make it faster. You cannot make it go faster. There's a certain limit to how fast you can do tea. And so that freaks out people, and me included, and sometimes, because it's like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm going to read emails while I do the tea, and I'm also going to get this book, and I'm going to, you know, tidy up this room. And every single time you do that, every single time you're not completely committed to what you're doing, something happens, right? In the case of tea, is the water will get overboiled every single time you do that. And so for me, I think it draws very interesting parallels when it comes to my job, because in my job, I try to apply the same behavioral patterns that I practice on all this traditional arts, right? The necessity of being completely focused and burning completely into one single task that you're doing. Also, the capacity of looking beyond the moment while being in the moment. Right. And so all these different patterns that for a lot of people tend to stay on the mat, I always try to find a way of bringing them to my job and to see parallels. For example, I talk with a lot of my clients and say, look, you're trying to fight with someone that's bigger than you are. And the way you're trying to achieve this is by going head to head against them. And as a startup, for example, which is some of my clients are startups, they have limited resources as a company to go against a big corporation or a big chunk of the market. And so I keep telling them, it's like, look, try to be leaner. Try to be more like what we do in Aikido. Especially I talk like this with people that have either practiced Aikido or done similar things. And I say, look, when you're training, you will never try to go against someone that's stronger than you are head to head. In Aikido, the whole point of this is blending with the energy you have. Now, as a company, you need to do exactly the same thing. Once again, the same lessons you have on the mat about, you know, the being natural, being in a state of flow is probably the hardest situation to develop, or the hardest thing to develop as a practitioner. And the same thing happens when you transpose this to the business aspect. So there are many, many parallels. This is just one example, but there's so many parallels that for me, it just makes me smile. Just to give another example, I remember when I started training, when I started learning Shodo, so Japanese calligraphy, and when I heard my teacher explain certain things, and she would say something like, look, Alex, you need to move your whole body. And it just made me giggle, because it was like, oh my God, I'm just back to Aikido 101. And she would go like, you need to breathe, Alex, you need to breathe. The brush is an extension of your body. And I'm like, oh, I've heard that before, but with a bouquet. And so.
Yeah, but chatting about it and discussing it and intellectualizing it and doing it is
Oh,
a
yeah.
different ball game,
Oh, yeah.
as you know. It's interesting, again, every time I have a chat, and I'm sure it's the same for you, multiple questions arise from a paragraph of or the equivalent of a paragraph in chat. For example, you talked about your wife saying hobby, and you saying practice, and with one of my more established students, and a good friend of mine, she uses the word hobby a lot. Well, look, we're from England, and the word hobby is a big thing in the vocabulary of little activities. And I'd get quite annoyed by it, because in my book, a hobby is a casual thing that you don't really take very seriously, and doesn't really go beyond playing around, mucking around. Whereas Aikido is not that, and Iaido is not that, and meditation is not that. And then she'd argue back, and she'd say, "Well, no, firstly, hobby doesn't not mean necessarily not serious. It could be very serious. Some people's hobbies become their professions. But for me, it's a hobby. For you, it's your profession. You've dedicated your life to this. So, is it, I don't know, is it semantics, or am I touchy about the word? Because it sounds, it's like that's, I think what I take from it is the sense that it diminishes what it is, and it's really shouldn't be taken that way. But maybe it doesn't matter. But moving on from that, in terms of the influence in your work, and now, and a great one you picked out there, and it really is. It's, what do you do when you come across something that's maybe cleverer or bigger, or has more resources than you, as you do in business? It becomes a very tricky situation, because if you try to take that head on, it's common sense. You don't have to be in the world of business to know that you're not going to get far. You don't have to be a great martial artist to know that the little guy versus the big guy is going to get into a complication that is not going to favor you if you don't know how to work with that. You don't disengage. You still have to engage, but you're going to have to work out something that can work for you, and to blend, to feel the other person, to feel the other guy, to get a sense of it, and how to make that ever advantageous for you. In the case of training, there's no outcome. There's no victor. There's no winner, in the sense that I'm stronger and better than you, and maybe you are. But in that sense, if someone is senior to you and stronger than you, their job is really, they're tasked with stimulating you and challenging you to get bigger, broader and bigger in what you do. In business, my guess is that you want to get some kind of a deal going here, a contract that is that'll embrace your product or embrace your ideas, and because if that's not the case, why is there an engagement in the first place? Why is the bigger lot talking to you? Because if they were not interested, they wouldn't be a dialogue to start with. So you've already crossed the first stage. You're already in the situation where, pardon me, you're talking and you're communicating. The question is how and what and how. And let's face it, you need your resources about you. And this is in anything we do. You need your intelligence, but it's not purely about being clever. You need to be able to address what do I have? What is my capacity? What do I have to offer? Which means you've got to be on your toes, and you've got to be able to present that stuff. And which brings me to the last point about this aspect of it, is that just recently, and the timing couldn't be worse, really, and possibly I mean, long term, it will be very good. But I've come up with a different a creation of my dojo of Aikido of London, which I've called it Zanshin, taken from the Japanese term used in meditation, used in Shodo, used in for sure in martial art. And it's a very crisp and beautiful description. In unbroken concentration is one example of it. Often in meditation, they describe the sound after the sound. The sound after the bell has actually stopped ringing, and that lingering part is, which is, again, addresses the notion of unbroken concentration. And what it says is really very powerful. To be present, but to be relaxed in that presence, and so not to be alert, to be awake, to be connected. In this case, the sound of the bell, or the after sound. In the case of the Iaido, the tip of the blade pointing towards an imagined protagonist, the imaginary enemy. You're not fighting a combat, a real enemy in terms of a physical body anymore. But the idea of developing your focus so that it doesn't disconnect, of quarter into the move, and then suddenly you disassociate, yeah, with the movement. You see it in football. Sportsmen have it in noodles. If you're playing high level football, and you, that moment when you switch off, let's say you're the goalkeeper, and it's been a very dominant game on your team's side. You're in Madrid. You've got a great team there, and they're going forward and forward, and the other team is really not getting a say in it. You, the goalkeeper, has got to have that mental focus and concentration, that zanshin, and yet you've got to be in a relaxed state. Otherwise, you're exhausted, yeah, and you can't sustain it. And yet you've got to keep it, because it's that one moment when there's a counterattack and you're caught off your wits. You're not there. You're not ready for it. And the manager and the team are probably wondering why they're paying you X millions a year for your job. And it's that teeny little thing that people obscure, and if you charge into things, you'll miss that. You don't even know it exists, let alone address it. Anyway, the whole notion of that description is to address people like yourself, actually, high level professionals who need to achieve a couple of things. Learn something that helps them relax and get acquainted with the body they have in a very interesting context, in a martial art called Aikido, the benefits of which you can't exactly calculate, because what is your goal? Well, what you've gained from it will be different from person B, C, D, E, F, G. No two are alike, but I'm sure there's overlaps. There's certain things that will cover.
I think you're very right. I mean, the way you were describing it made me think about something very interesting. You were addressing the uke-nage combination, right? When you're going against someone that's stronger than you, and that to a certain point, if it's someone with more experience, they will ideally, as a good uke or a good nage, they will ideally help you grow as a practitioner. Now, I was thinking about the metaphor when it comes to businesses and how we talk a lot about disruption and innovation and technology and how the corporations try to you know, squash innovative companies, innovative young companies. And it's an interesting parallel, because a lot of voices are saying, you need to be more flexible. As the big guys, you need to learn how to train with the small guys, because you're also going to get something out of it, right? And if the corporation or if the big company doesn't understand that and it just turns into a bully, then they will never reap the benefits of dealing with someone that's leaner than they are, right? And so there's a lot of parallels like this that I think are beautiful. And what you talked about, Sanxing, I think it's spot on. I was thinking, and honestly, I think it's pretty relevant to the current situation. I see maybe way too many people, me included, to be honest, which shows you how human we are, even with training and even with practice. For me, this situation has been slightly rattling, in the sense that there's such a level of uncertainty in more ways than one. I have three kids. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay the schools. I don't know. We were going to take them to a certain school, and now we have to switch because financially it might not be the best option. Then my job, I don't know if it's going to keep on going. My partners, I don't know if they're going to keep going. So there's all this tiny pieces of your world that have been completely upset, and with high levels of uncertainty, not just in one area, but actually all across the board. And I was thinking that capacity of being present in the moment that you see on the mat all the time, sometimes you see people I, you know this firsthand because you've told me many times as a sensei that sometimes we overthink things. We're thinking about what the technique should be, where you should put someone, and it's your brain doing the work instead of just being present and letting it just flow and relax and be in the moment. The same thing, I see the same situation in business where a lot of people, especially now, are trying to control absolutely everything. And it's funny because the more you try to control a completely wacko situation like the one we're experiencing, the higher the levels of anxiety are, right? And the higher the frustration. And I think that's a very valuable lesson you can bring from traditional art training or practice, is that
I'm giggling because you're a little younger than I am, but I don't know if the term still exists. I think it's an Americanism of shit happens, yep. Hey, and it's and sometimes you I suppose you're addressing the notions of rolling with it, and if you fight it, you're going to lose. If you confront it, you're going to lose. If you ignore it, you're going to lose. And so you have to get out of that mindset and just try and take things as they come, not casual, but also not exactly fraught with anxiety, which is easy to say. I mean, there are people. I was again just a couple of weeks ago, as the lockdown was taking a hold. If you're in a relatively fortunate situation, and we are, and you've addressed a difficulty that you have to consider for your future with your children, and so things have changed, and that may be corrected, but it's not going to be a disaster at the end of it. At least it doesn't seem like it. But there are people where their companies are going to go, they're going to disappear, their things are going to fold. They don't know what they're going to be doing the next day. And we're talking about mothers and with you know, single parents to be precise, with enormous difficulties. And I speak for myself. I would not have the nerve to speak to someone and say to them, "Well, look, you've got to roll with this." They probably do in their own way because they've got no choice. You know, they suddenly the space for manoeuvring has been closed and closed, and suddenly lockdown for them is literally lockdown. Even if the doors are wide open tomorrow, they're locked into a scenario that is very difficult. And but for some people, they will flourish in that. It's the opposite. They will see an opportunity. They'll see a chance, or something in them is awoken out of this that gives them an impetus, a drive. And but I'm getting into a different territory.
But I think it's very relevant. I was just thinking that when you feel like that, at least for me, it helps a lot to bring back my training in other spaces, in other practices. You know, if I have that situation in my job, I keep trying to remember how I've dealt with it on the mat, or how I've dealt with that when I had a brush, for example. And it seems weird because I see too many people that compartmentalize this, right? So I train, and what I do on the mat stays on the mat. And the moment I go out of the door, then I'm someone else. I'm someone different. But for me, it's always been quite the opposite. There's a phrase we used to say a lot at the dojo. It's like, Aikido is not what you do on the mat. On the mat, you do physical exercises to help you understand very abstract concepts. Aikido is what you do when you get out of that door, when you get out of the dojo. That's the real deal. That's the real battle. And being able to take your physical training to another dimension, to another plane, it's what's hard, and it's what maybe in certain ways is extremely rewarding beyond the physical plane.
If I take one part of that, I think this is very much linked with the practice of Zen Buddhism, and not as a religion, but in terms of the sitting aspect as a meditation. And there's if you do a retreat and a couple of people from my dojo will know what I'm talking about. There's a practice called Kinhin, which is when you sit, it can be pretty intense. It can be pretty challenging, in some ways more challenging than martial art. As you're addressing three things: your posture, your breath, and your thinking, and letting those thoughts flow, no matter how how interesting or uninteresting they may be. It's not that you ignore them; it's just you don't attach yourself to them. And much harder to do than it sounds. Anyway, the sits themselves last for various periods, 15, 20 minutes, up to 45 minutes, depending on the capacity of the participants and the head of the meditation retreat leading it. But you can't sit indefinitely like that. No person's legs or hips can endure it, and it's not a particularly healthy thing to do mentally, physically, or otherwise. So what you do is you get up. Maybe you switch legs and try the other side, but maybe after two goes like that, three, maybe four at a push, you get up and you walk around the zendo, which is the hall of the practice. And, and in that kinhin, you fold your wrists and your hands in front of your chest, and you walk at a very specific, very pedantic pace. And it's not about falling asleep or just purely stretching your legs. The idea is that when you get up, you bring whatever you're working towards in your sitting. You don't suddenly switch off. Ah, thank God, it's over. Now I can shake it off a little bit and do that. No, if you have the discipline and you're in the flow, so to speak, in the zone, so to speak, you can. That continues. Maybe a milder form of it just continues, and it gives your blood and circulation a chance to address itself. You come back and you're ready to do more. If you do a weekend of that, that's a pretty intensive experience. But the idea is that when you leave and you go back to your real life, your daily life, your main life, you hopefully a little bit of something of that practice comes with you, and it becomes a part of you. So when people speak of a martial art as being a path, a way, or your Zen being as a way of life, you could look at it in that kind of way that, look, this stuff is influencing me. Maybe I'm calmer at work, or there's a zone that meditation creates that is carrying on. It's become a part of me now, and I can take that wherever I go, a little haven within you that gives you peace of mind, whatever it is for that individual. I can assure you that for some people, there's a battleground going on in there. There is no peace or calm in that way. Whether they are troubled or not, it really depends on how they deal with that. But it's not for them to be present, for them to get the closest thing towards calm, is to not go crazy and not to shoot off at a tangent with what they're doing.
I think it's very important.
But if I can complete it, Alex, there's a flip side to this. Because we're generally the direction we're talking about is Aikido, what you get out of it, Zanshin project that I've mentioned, what you can get out of it. Yes, there's the fitness and there's the energy and the enthusiasm and the enjoyment and then there's the benefits. But there's a flip side to this. What do you the participant, bring to your meditation? What do you bring to your Aikido? Are you bringing enthusiasm that the teacher sees and, great, someone I can work with? Are you bringing an attitude where the other students look at it and they think, what a great guy or great gal, and I really enjoy with this person, or they're awkward, but hey, we'll work it out. Hey, I was awkward once as well. And then we're all on a journey and we have to be patient and give each other enough room to make our way. And so that's the part that's always ignored, especially today where, in our consumerist mentality is, I've paid my fee, you said I can come. Okay, teach me. And whereas really, it's not, that's a, like a very, I pay money, you teach. It sounds logical and obvious, but actually the answer is, I'm going to teach anyway. That's what I do. Whether you're here or not, I teach. That's my my task when I walk through those doors at a dojo. The question is there sufficient, are you bringing sufficient material in terms of your presence of mind or willing to acquire some of that? Are you bringing that aspect of yourself into that class? And then you get the benefits of the class, and the art gets the benefit of that person's contribution towards it. And then it flips around, and then you leave, and there's a flux in it, back and forth, which brings me to the second part of your thing. I'm not letting you in, not quite yet. The second part being, we've addressed the habit building part, and we've kind of have a connection now from that. We've sort of shifted onto slightly different things, and the long term, the focus on the long term, a path for the long term for gradual betterment, which is a little bit of what I'm addressing now. This dialogue of back and forth, good days and bad days, bringing good attitudes, sometimes bad attitudes, but the longer overall picture is a bigger vision of gradual self-improvement and betterment for yourself and hopefully beyond in the world that we live in. If this is
No,
possible,
I think this
please
is
go
a
ahead, Alex.
fundamental point in that makes, for me, at least for me, the biggest difference. That's for me the difference between a hobby and a practice, between an exercise and a path. And I'll use the word path mostly because in Asian philosophy, the Tao, the Do in Japan, it's something deeper than just the meaning of the word path. I do a lot of translation from Chinese and Japanese, and one of the striking things when you do these translations is that for Westerners, it's very, very hard to understand that the level of ambiguity that a term has in Chinese, especially in classic or ancient Chinese, it's massive. And it's done on
Pardon
purpose
me.
because the idea or the philosophy behind it is that the more you acquire as a person, the more dimensions you'll see to the term. So when you transpose this notion of Do, of path, of Tao to a practice, then you start unpacking all these layers that take you to the infinite. And depending where you are in your path, you will see it differently or you will interpret it differently. And connecting to that, and as I was saying, for me, that's the biggest difference between a hobby and a practice. A practice is this path that transforms you, that as you keep walking it will change your perspective, it will change your way of thinking, the way of seeing, the way of perceiving, and many different aspects. And I think you touch on, for me, maybe the hardest issue or the hardest or the biggest challenge for anyone doing this kind of traditional arts or habit building beyond the hobby part, right? Which is understanding, as you said before, that there will be bad days. For me, I've experienced this many times, but maybe one of the hardest ones is when I've done calligraphy. And you do a calligraphy that, if you excuse my language, looks like shit. And someone, you give it to someone, and someone frames it. And then you go and visit this friends of yours. Maybe it's a common visit, and you keep staring at this calligraphy, or more like the calligraphy stares at your face constantly as a reminder of, like, hey, man. Remember how badly you did this calligraphy? And I remember that at the beginning it was very nerve-wracking to do that. Like, there's this fear of doing calligraphies and giving them away, or even framing them, or putting them on a dojo or whatever, because it's going to be a reminder of, hey, where were you at that point? But eventually, once you recover from that kind of shock, it's interesting because it's a nice reminder of you are human and you will fail and the path never ends. And whatever calligraphy you do now, there will be problems with it. And if you frame something that you do now and you look at it 3 years later, you'll see the problems. And if you do it that at that point and frame it again, you'll still see problems as you keep moving. And so that capacity.
That is also no, but the nature of art.
I would say though, art, and I would say everything. That's for me was the biggest lesson here, is that that is our day to day as human beings, no matter what you do. It happens in business. It happens as a parent. It happens as a partner. You will have bad days. And there will be days they will go like, oh my God, this was horrible. But...
Well, there's no... there's. You're basically saying there's no exactly. such thing as perfection, and there's a constant striving, and also chill time. No matter how great an accomplishment that someone has, even the mightiest have to sit back and maybe put your legs up and watch a TV show or go golfing or fishing or whatever your chill time. Is so there's no one can be on these things all the time, and even if you are, the mistakes they will come quite naturally in a way. I think in Far Eastern, but certainly in Japanese tradition, the deeper rooted stuff is I believe the term is wabi sabi, the rustic quality. But there's another aspect. I'm not sure if it's exactly with that principle, but there's the notion that I remember Chibo-sensei pointing out that like a craftsman who's making a suba, a sword guard for a katana, that they actually put a flaw in it in terms of the artistry is not perfect, and it's supposed to be about humility, God, if you're a believer, and the idea that I'm just a humble human being in the scheme of things. Only the cosmic awareness in the universe is perfect, and so this is your way of showing humility. That's a very conscious way, and probably a deeply cultural way of expressing a certain kind of spirituality. Whereas I would argue, my personal take on that one, I don't think there is any need to try and consciously put a flaw into something in that sense, that you're going to do that anyway, you know, regardless. They're, that's going to happen.
Well, I'll give you a British example for this with tea. You know, when you... British tea.
Or
it's funny because when people look at my feeds and they read what I do about tea, and now I even do workshops... Yeah,
I saw your red tea just yesterday, I think, or this morning.
Exactly. But it's funny because a lot of people that follow these things, they maybe we meet for coffee or tea, or they invite me to the place, and they start apologizing and saying, excuse me, I only have bagged tea, and I know you don't drink this. And it's funny because I sometimes tell them, look, it's okay. It's fine. This okay tea. It's a different thing. And if you're not okay with that, if you're, as you said before, constantly looking for perfection, you're just not realizing in what world we live in. And sitting down, sharing an experience with something is more important than the actual tea. And
yeah, completely. It's you're talking about the human factor now, rather than just purely the... Well, if you want to be contemporary about it, 4 weeks ago now, I read an article, I think, I can't remember which newspaper, The Independent, the Times, maybe The Guardian. I read snippets here and there. And someone was addressing the fact that people will now realise that work and coffee shops and going to the gym and everything is not purely functional. I talk of habits, you know, going to work purely for making money, going to the gym just purely to get fit, going to the coffee shop just for a cup of coffee, going shopping just to get yourself supplies. And the realization is that when the high street is dead and the city's dead and you're not going, you've taken more than just money away. You've taken and functionality. It's social. It's human. You've taken something that we take for granted, and I was quite annoyed actually because Is this a very well-paid reporter being paid to say what is what I would call self-evident? Is like no shit, Sherlock. There's the human engagement, and whether you're doing it on a conscious level, you know, through a practice or a path or a system of training, or whether you're doing it within a purely functional situation where you're going to work. Let's face it, most people, or a lot of people, if not most. Yeah. Their social life may center around their professional life. That's where you're hanging out with those people more than anywhere else. Maybe those things are changing now. If as what we're doing with the remote discussion, this brings another level of communication. But it's no substitute for the physical presence in my book. So I'm a bit old fashioned that way. I love technology. I've embraced it ever since I could remember. But I'm not devoid of the physical contact. Aikido is more than physical, but the mechanism is physical, and there's no getting around that. But something else transmits itself in the process of training. For example, back to the high street, back to the job. In training, is very specific. The person to person exchange is going on there. Yeah. You pick up on their energy, and they pick up on your energy. What is that energy? It's not some Star Wars abstract energy force that projects out of your fingers. It's the human being on the other side, and how it characterizes them, and how it's expressed within this particular context. And it's rich, because if we don't look at it that way, then it's just a couple of guys who want to develop their bodies and muscles in a different way than a gym. And they'd like to roll around and whack the mat a little bit, and you're going to learn that anyway. You know, you're going to learn the technical part, the development part will go along, but the human being behind it is critical, and the social time for people is critical.
I think that is one of the major lessons here. One of the things I love about Aikido, and I always explain it like this to people that don't know what Aikido is about, is what I love about Aikido is that you train with a team. You don't train on your own. You have a team. And that for me is beautiful. And even if you do solo training, if you do your Yaido, or if you do, like we were doing before, the Suburi training, you still, you know, even it is the same thing happens in meditation. You can meditate on your own, but there's this feeling that you're meditating in a room with other people, even though you're not talking to them, that it's contagious. And it's exactly what you just said.
I actually know monks who have given advice to a couple of people. This is back in my USA days. I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's a long, long, long time ago. But the advice that was given to a couple of guys was, don't meditate on your own. It's not advisable. Meaning, it's okay to meditate on your own at times, but you have to go, and there has to be somewhere where you can go where there's a group of you, because that's much more about what it is. And then the rest of the time, you do your stuff at home, but not exclusively at home. And I think, like you said about Aikido, we need each other to train. But you can do suburis, and you can do stretching, and you can do Aikido-related exercises, but in the end, Aikido does not exist in the ether. It's when at least two people come together. Interesting point on that. I always deliberate on my trip. I was in Japan last year, 4 years ago, and nearly 6 years ago now. Each one a bigger and better surprise each time, and I love it very much. But it's very important for the fact that I learned more about Japan in California than I ever learned in Japan. But by being there, suddenly you're experiencing in the backdrop the undercurrent, the energy flows of society that are very interesting. That the idea of engagement in terms of Nage and Uke is actually constantly going on in society. It is there. Now you can argue, if you take it purely as a technical thing, that I'm the thrower, you're the receiver, and you fall in your role, that's a very narrow and limited way. But if you look at it as a more subtle thing, and We do it in as human nature in any part of the world, I would argue. But when it's a conscious product of a society that's worked towards it, that the people who are engaged in it may not be fully conscious of it, and you go crazy if you were. It's so crowded, and what it is you're taught at a very young age. It's around you, and it's constantly enhanced in school, and then it continues into the workplace. And of course, we know about the hierarchy, but the hierarchy is another matter. That's a different subject. But the ebb and flow and movement is there, and every now and then you get a clash. But they are very rare there, and it's not the way. There's something very beautiful about it, actually. That I, as an individual, and everyone has to speak for themselves, but I, as a visitor, enjoy it, and,
Well,
and
but
I recognize it from.
But as you were
a
saying
condensed
before,
form,
I
as I
think
often say
that's,
in training.
I would say, to close this conversation, that's one of the key lessons for me, is that this kind of traditional arts, even if they apparently have an individualistic form, they have a strong undercurrent of collaboration and doing things socially, right? And I think that in a society like ours, where we keep pushing everyone to be more and more individual, it's good to have these reminders for your own sake, for your own personal life, but also for your jobs, to have this space where you're reminded that working together is very enriching, and it's part, if not the essence, of humanity as society, right? So for me, it's always a nice reminder, even with tea, right? I love doing tea on my own, but I would hands down would love much more to serve tea to someone than to drink tea on my own, like every single time.
So the solution to our problems is serve someone a cup of tea. I'm joking, but there may be a kernel of truth in there somewhere. I think you're right, Leon, pardon me, Alex. It's good to close it now, and it's been great. I think there's a lot of material there that
Definitely. It's
we've covered,
always
and
a pleasure
hopefully food
talking
for
with
thought.
you and sharing this with all our fellow trainers and fellow practitioners.
And also, hopefully see you sometime. I get the
Well,
feeling this year is not
well,
going to
you
be
won't be
good.
surprised if it's not.
You have been listening to the IGNITE of London discussion series.